Simon started to tell me why they got Rose all wrong. "It's because she's so original," he said.
"Original? Rose?"
"Why, of course. Even the way she dresses. That frilly pink dress. And borrowing a real crinoline. It was Topaz who thought of all that, but I stopped in mid-sentence.
"Pretty, wasn't it?"
I finished up. "Everything about her's pretty." He went on to talk of her for quite a quarter of a mile. How different she was from the average modern girl. And because of that he hadn't understood her, had thought her affected. When what she was, of course, was unique. Everything Rose does is original, apparently. Even the way she dances, inventing little steps of her own. And she is so intelligent. He kindly said I was, too. But Rose is a wit, a fact not as yet disclosed to her family. As for looks, she'd have been a toast at any period of history. I could wholeheartedly agree about the looks. I told him I could imagine her arriving at Bath with all the bells ringing and Beau Nash welcoming her as the reigning beauty. That fetched him considerably. Rose lasted us until we were passing the larchwood, when he stopped and spoke about the greenness of the larches. "There'll be bluebells in there before long. You can see the shoots now," I told him. He stood staring into the wood for a minute, then said, "What is it about the English countryside? Why is the beauty so much more than visual? Why does it touch one so?" He sounded faintly sad. Perhaps he finds beauty saddening. I do myself sometimes. Once, when I was quite little, I asked Father why this was, and he explained that it was due to our knowledge of beauty's evanescence, which reminds us that we ourselves shall die. Then he said I was probably too young to understand him, but I understood perfectly. As we walked on, I asked Simon questions about American country, and he described some of the old New England villages. They did sound nice, very trim and white, much more spacious than our villages, with wide streets lined with shady trees. And he told me about little places on the coast of Maine, where he had spent vacations. He says, vacations, where we would say holidays. Although I still think his voice is like extra good English. I now realize that almost every sentence he speaks has some little American twist. Guess, for suppose. Maybe, where we use perhaps. I've gotten, when we would say, I've got. Oh, there are dozens of words. And he is much more American with me than he is with Father, and very much younger. With Father, he chooses his words so correctly that he sounds quite pedantic and middle-aged. But with me, he was almost boyish. "Why, the May's out already," I said, when we came to the crossroads. The buds on the hedges were tightly closed, but there were dozens of open ones on the tree by the signpost. I set a lot of store by May. I once spent hours trying to describe a single blossom of it, but I only managed frank-eyed, floweret, kitten-whiskered, which sticks in your throat like fish bones. "The palm and May make country houses gay," quoted Simon. I think it's that poem that makes me feel the Elizabethans lived in perpetual spring. Then we remembered the rest of the poem between us, and by the time we got to "Young lovers meet, old wives a-sunning sit, in every street these tunes our ears do greet, cuckoo, jug-jug, poo-wee, to-wit, to-woo," we were into the village. "Can you hear any birds obliging with those noises?" I said.
"Let's listen," said Simon.
We listened. We heard somebody hammering, a hen announcing an egg, a cottage wireless saying it was the British Broadcasting Corporation, the pump on the village green clanking. All rather ugly noises, really, but the church clock striking the quarter somehow drew them together into one pleasant country sound floating on the light spring air. Then Heloise shattered it all by flapping her ears after rolling on the green.
"And how many things can you smell?"
I asked Simon. We counted up.
Wood smoke.
A farm smell coming on puffs of breeze. We subdivided this into straw, hay, horses, clean cows. Good. Manure, pigs, hens, old cabbages. Bad. but not too awful, if only in little whiffs. A wonderful pie cooking somewhere. The sweet, fresh smell which isn't quite flowers or grass or scent of any kind, but just clean country air. One forgets to notice this unless one reminds oneself. I wonder how many more things Heloise smells, said Simon. Let's see. What could Chesterton's dog, Quoodle, smell? Water and stone and dew and thunder. And Sunday morning. He was so right about that having a smell of its own, said Simon. Oh, it's amicable being with someone who knows the poems you know. I do hope I get Simon for a brother-in-law. We crossed the green and turned down the short lane that leads to the prettiest bit of God's End. The church, which is Norman, and a bit of it may be Saxon, stands on one side of the lane between the Queen Anne Vicarage and Miss Marcy's little 18th-century schoolhouse. The Keys Inn is opposite, but because the lane curves just there, they all seem part of one group. Topaz says, the composition is very beautiful. The Keys is painted cream and has very irregular gables. Beside it is an enormous chestnut tree. Not in bloom yet, but its leaves are at their very best, all new and vividly green, with some of the sticky buds still unopened. There is a bench with a long table against the front of the inn, partly shaded by the chestnut, and sitting there, with stone bottles of ginger beer, were Rose and Neil. It turned out that she'd come across the fields from Four Stones to get a cake of scented soap from the post office shop. Topaz is giving us a shilling a week pocket money while the vicar's £20 holds out. And had found Neil there, buying cigarettes. And when I said you'd be along soon, she very obligingly waited, he told Simon. Perhaps I imagined it, but I did think he sounded a bit satirical. We sat down, Simon by Rose. Neil asked me what I would have to drink. I was going to say lemonade, and then a wild idea struck me. Could I have a cherry brandy? I've always wanted to taste it. You can't drink liqueurs before lunch, said Rose in a very grown-up way. Yes, she can, if she wants to, said Neil, going into the bar. Rose shrugged her shoulders rather histrionically and turned to talk to Simon. He did look pleased to see her. After a few minutes, he suggested we should all lunch there and called out to Neil to arrange it. As a rule, Mrs. Jakes only serves bread and cheese, but she managed cold sausages as well, and some honey and cake. Neil ate his sausage with honey, which simply fascinated me. But by then, almost everything was fascinating me. Cherry brandy is wonderful. But I don't think my haze of content was all due to the cherry brandy. The glasses are so small. I had lemonade for my first. It was everything together that was so pleasant. The food out of doors, the sunshine, the sky through the chestnut tree, Neil being nice to me, and Simon being more than nice to Rose, and, of course, the cherry brandy did help. While Neil was getting my second glass, I took a good look at Rose. She was wearing her very oldest dress, a washed-out blue cotton, but it looked exactly right for sitting outside an inn. One branch of the chestnut came down behind her head, and while I was watching, a strand of her bright hair got caught across a leaf. "Is that branch worrying you?" Simon asked her. "Would you like to change places?" "I hope you wouldn't, because your hair looks so nice against the leaves." I was glad he had been noticing. Rose said the branch wasn't worrying her in the least. When Neil came back with my second cherry brandy, she said, "Well, now that we've finished lunch, I'll have one too." I knew very well she had been envying mine. Then she called after him, "No, I won't. I'll have a creme de menthe." I was surprised because we both tasted that at Aunt Millicent's once and hated it heartily. But I saw what she was after when she got it. She kept holding it up so that the green looked beautiful against her hair. Though, of course, it clashed quite dreadfully with the chestnut leaves. I must say she was being more affected than I ever saw her. But Simon appeared to be enchanted. Neil didn't. He winked at me once and said, "Your sister'll be wearing that drink as a hat any minute." Neil is amusing, though it is more the laconic way he says things than what he actually says. Sometimes he sounds almost grim, and yet you know he is joking. I believe this is called wisecracking. Rose was right when she said he thinks England is a joke, a comic sort of toy. But I don't believe he despises it, as she feels he does. It is just that he doesn't take it seriously. I am rather surprised that Rose resents him so much, because England isn't one of her special things in the way it is mine. Oh, not flags and Kipling and outposts of empire and such, but the country and London and houses like Scotney. Eating bread and cheese at an inn felt most beautifully English, though the liqueurs made it a bit fancy. Mrs. Jakes has had those two bottles for as long as I can remember, both full to the top. We sat talking until the church clock struck two, and then the nicest thing of all happened. Miss Marcy began a singing class. The windows of the schoolhouse were open, and the children's voices came floating out very high and clear. They were doing rounds. First, "My dame hath a lame tame crane." Then, "Now, Robin, lend to me thy bow." And then, "Summer is a-comin' in," which is my very favourite tune. When I learnt it at school, it was part of a lesson on Chaucer and Langland, and that was one of the few times when I had a flash of being back in the past. While I listened to Miss Marcy's children singing, I seemed to capture everything together. Medieval England, myself at 10, the summers of the past and the summer really coming. I can't imagine ever feeling happier than I did for those moments, and while I was telling myself so, Simon said, "Did anything as beautiful as this ever happen before?" "Let's take the kids some lemonade," said Neil. So we got 2 dozen bottles and carried them across. Miss Marcy nearly swooned with delight and introduced Simon to the children as Squire of Godsend and Scotney. "Go on, make a speech. It's expected," I whispered. He took me seriously and gave me an agonized look. Then he told them how much he had enjoyed the singing and that he hoped they would all come to Scotney one day and sing for his mother. Everyone applauded, except one very small child who howled and got under her desk. I think she was scared of his beard. We left after that, and the Cottons said they would drive us home. Neil went to settle with Mrs. Jakes, and I routed Heloise out of the kitchen. She was bloated with sausage. When I came back, Simon was leaning against the chestnut, staring at the schoolhouse. "Will you look at that window?" he said. I looked. It is a tallish window, with an arched top. On the sill inside stood a straggly late hyacinth with its white roots growing in water, a jam jar of tadpoles and a hedgehog. "It'd be nice to paint," I said. "I was just thinking that. If I were a painter, I believe I'd always paint windows." I looked up at the inn. "There's another for you," I told him. Close to the swinging signboard with its crossed gold keys, there was a diamond-paned lattice open, showing dark red curtains and a little sprigged jug and basin with the brass knob and black rail of an iron bedstead behind it. It was wonderfully paintable. "Everywhere one turns." He stared all around, as if he were trying to memorize things. The vicar's housekeeper drew the blinds down against the sun, so that the vicarage seemed to close its eyes. Mrs. Jakes had told us the vicar was out, or we would have called on him. Miss Marcy's children were very quiet. I suppose they were all guzzling lemonade. There was a moment of great peace and silence. Then the clock struck the half hour. A white pigeon alighted with a great flutter of wings on the inn roof just above the open window, and Neil started the car. "Don't you think this beautiful?" Simon asked him, as we went over. "Yes, pretty as a picture," said Neil. "The kind you get on jigsaw puzzles." "You're hopeless," I said, laughing. I did know what he meant, of course, but no amount of pretty, pretty pictures can ever really destroy the beauty of villages like Godsend. Rose went in the back of the car with Simon. Heloise and I were at the front. Part of the time Neil drove with his arm round her. "Gosh, what sex appeal she has," he said. Then he told her she was a cute pooch. But would she please not wash his ears? Not that it stopped her. Heloise can never see a human ear at tongue level without being a mother to it. When we got back to the castle, I felt it was only polite to ask them in. But Neil had made an appointment for Simon with the Scotney agent. Simon is obviously most anxious to understand everything about the estate. But I don't think the agricultural side comes naturally to him. It does to Neil, which seems a waste when he isn't staying in England.
Did Simon fix anything about seeing us again? I asked Rose as we watched them drive away. Don't worry, they'll be round. She spoke quite scornfully. I resented it after the Cottons had been so nice to us. Very sure of yourself, aren't you? I said. Then something struck me. Oh, Rose, you're not still counting it against them, what I overheard them say about you. I am against Neil. He's my enemy. She flung back her head dramatically. I told her not to be an idiot. But he is. He as good as told me so before you came this morning. He said he was still hoping Simon would come back to America with him. Well, that doesn't make him your enemy, I said. But I must admit that his manner to her is a bit antagonistic. Of course, owning Scotney is really what is likely to keep Simon in England. But I suppose marrying an English girl would tend to as well. Yes, it does. Anyway, I hate him. But he shan't interfere. She was flushed, and her eyes had a desperate look, a look that somehow made me ashamed for her. Oh, Rose, don't bank on things too much, I begged. Simon may not have the faintest idea of proposing. American men are used to being just friends with girls. And they probably think we're too comic for words, just as Neil thinks the English country is. Blast Neil, she cried furiously. I would rather see her furious than desperate. It made me think of the day she turned on a bull that was chasing us. It turned out to be a rather oddly shaped cow. Remembering this made me feel very fond of her. So I told her all the nice things Simon had said about her on our walk to God's End, and I made her promise never to tell him I had lied to him, even if she marries him. I should hate him to know, even though I did do it to be kind. Oh, I see more and more that I ought never to have let her get it out of me, that conversation I overheard. It not only started her off hating Neil, but has made her extra relentless to Simon. She will marry him or burst. We found Topaz asleep on the drawing-room window seat. She looked as if she had been crying, but she woke up quite cheerfully and said our lunch was in the oven between plates. We had it for tea. When we finished telling her about the Cottons, she said, "How on earth are we to return their hospitality? I've been wondering ever since we went to Scotney. Dinner's impossible with no dining-room furniture. Could we manage a picnic lunch?" "No, we couldn't," said Rose. "We'd only make a mess of it. Leave them alone. Let them run after us." She went off upstairs. Topaz said, "Don't blame her too much. The first time girls feel their power, it often takes them like that." Then she yawned so much that I left her to finish her nap. I got my journal from the barn and remembered Leader Fox Cotton's note to Stephen inside. I told myself it was ridiculous to feel resentful and that I wouldn't even mention the note to him. I would just leave it where he would be sure to find it when he came back from work. I thought he might not want the others to see it. I felt Rose was liable to be scornful, so I took it to his room. I couldn't remember being there since we first explored the castle, when that was the bit of the kitchen where the hen roosts were. Father turned it into two little rooms which Stephen and his mother had. Hers is just a storeroom now. When I opened Stephen's door, I was quite shocked at the darkness and dankness. The narrow window was almost overgrown with ivy, and the whitewash on the walls was discoloured and peeling off in flakes. There was a narrow sagging bed, very neatly made, a once-white chest of drawers with screws sticking out where the handles had come off, and three hooks on the wall for clothes. On the chest of drawers, his comb was placed exactly midway between a photograph of his mother, with him as a baby in her arms, and a snapshot of me, both in aluminium frames, much too large for them. By the bed was an old wooden box, with a copy of Jacob Wrestling Father gave him years ago on it, beside a volume of Swinburne. Oh dear, is Stephen taking to Swinburne? That was absolutely all. No carpet, no chair. The room smelt damp and earthy. It didn't feel like anywhere in the castle as we know it now, but as the kitchen did when we saw it first, at sunset. I wondered if Stephen was haunted by the ghosts of ancient hens. I looked at the photograph of Mrs. Colley for a long time, remembering how kind she was to us in the years after Mother died. And I remembered going to see her in the cottage hospital, and then helping Father to break it to Stephen that she wasn't going to get better. He just said, "That's bad. Thank you, sir." "Will that be all now?" And went into his room. After she died, I felt he must be terribly lonely, and I got into the habit of reading to him in the kitchen every night. I expect I rather fancied myself reading aloud. It was then that he got fond of poetry. Father married Topaz the year after, and in the excitement of it all, my evenings with Stephen ended. I had forgotten all about them until I stood there looking at his mother's photograph. I imagined she was looking at me reproachfully because I hadn't been kinder to her son, and I wondered if I could do anything to improve his bedroom. I could make him some curtains, if Topaz could ever spare the money for them. But the window with the ivy creeping through is the nicest thing in the room, so it would be a pity to hide it. And always at the back of my mind I know it isn't kind to be kind to Stephen. Briskness is kindest. I looked Mrs. Colley in the eye and sent her a message. I'm doing my best. Really, I am. Then I thought that it would be better for Stephen not to know I had been in his room. I don't know why exactly, except that bedrooms are very personal, and he might not like to think I knew what a poor little place it is. I had one last look round. The afternoon sun was filtering in through the ivy so that everything was bathed in green light. The clothes hanging on the wall had a tired, almost dead look. If I had left the letter, he would have guessed that I had put it there. So in the end, I just gave it to him as soon as he came back from work. I explained how it had come, in a very casual voice, and then ran upstairs. He made no comment at all except to thank me. I still don't know what his plans about London are. In the evening, while I was working on my journal in the drawing room, Father walked in. I had been so absorbed that I hadn't heard him arrive home. "Hello, did your business go well?" I inquired politely. He said, "Business? What business? I've been to the British Museum." Then he made a dive at my journal. I pulled it away from him, staring in astonishment. "Good heavens, I don't want to pry into your secrets," he said. "I just want to look at your speed writing. Do me an example, if you prefer it. Do God Save the King." I thought you might as well see the journal. I chose an unprivate page in case he was better at guessing than Simon had been. He peered down, then pulled the candle closer and asked me to point out the word symbols. "There aren't any," I told him. "It's mostly just abbreviations." "No good. No good at all," he said impatiently, pushing the exercise book away. Then he marched off to the gatehouse. I went into the kitchen and found Topaz cutting ham sandwiches for him. She said he hadn't told her one word of what he'd been doing all day. "Well, he wasn't with Mrs. Cotton anyway," I said, "because he was at the British Museum." "As if that proves anything," said Topaz gloomily. "People do nothing but use it for assignations. I met him there myself once, in the mummy room." She went off to the gatehouse with his sandwiches. He had asked her to bring them to him there. When she came back, she said, "Cassandra, he's going out of his mind. He's got a sheet of graph paper pinned to his desk, and he told me to ask Thomas to lend him some compasses. And when I told him Thomas was asleep, he said, 'Then bring me a goat.' Oh, go to bed, go to bed. Heavens, does he really want a goat?" "Of course not," I said, laughing. "It's just an idiotic association of words, you know. Goat and compasses. They sometimes call inns that. I've heard him make that sort of joke before, and very silly I always think it is." She looked faintly disappointed. I think she had rather fancied hauling some goat in out of the night. A few minutes later, Father came rampaging into the kitchen, saying he must have the compasses, even if it meant waking Thomas. But I crept into his room and managed to sneak them out of his school satchel without disturbing him. Father went off with them. It was 3 o'clock before he finally came in from the gatehouse. I heard God's End Church clock strike just after he wakened Heloise, who raised the roof. Fancy sitting up until 3 in the morning playing with graph paper and compasses. I could hit him. Chapter 10. Oh, I long to blurt out the news in my first paragraph, but I won't. This is a chance to teach myself the art of suspense. We didn't hear anything from the Cottons for nearly 2 weeks after we lunched in the village, but we hardly expected to, as they were still in London. And while I was describing that day, it was like reliving it, so I was quite contented. And it took me a long time as Topaz developed a mania for washing, mending and cleaning, and she needed my help. I had to do most of my writing in bed at night, which stopped me from encouraging Rose to talk much. Not that she had shown signs of wanting to, having taken to going for long walks by herself. This desire for solitude often overcomes her at house-cleaning times. I finished writing of May Day on the second Saturday after it, and immediately felt it was time something else happened. I looked across at Rose in the four-poster and asked if she knew exactly when the Cottons were coming back.
"Oh, they're back now," she said casually.
She'd heard it in Godsend that morning and kept it to herself. "Don't count on seeing them too soon," she added. "Neil will keep Simon away from me as long as he can."
"Rubbish," I said, though I really had come to believe that Neil disliked her.
I tried to get her to talk some more. I was ready to enjoy a little exciting anticipation, but she wasn't forthcoming. And I quite understood. When things mean a very great deal to you, exciting anticipation just isn't safe. The next day, Sunday, something happened to put the Cottons out of my head. When I got down, Topaz told me Stephen had gone off to London. He hadn't said a word to anyone until she came down to get breakfast and found him ready to start.
"He was very calm and collected," she said. "I asked him if he wasn't afraid of getting lost, and he said that if he did, he'd get a taxi. But he hardly thought he would need to, as Miss Marcy had told him exactly which buses to take."
I was suddenly furious at his asking Miss Marcy when he had been so secretive with us.
"I hate that Fox Cotton woman," I said. "Well, I warned him to keep his eyes open," said Topaz. "And of course her interest really may be only professional, though I must say I doubt it."
"Do you mean she might make love to him?" I gasped, and for the first time really knew just why I minded his going.
"Well, somebody will, sooner or later. But I'd rather it was some nice girl in the village. It's no use looking horrified, Cassandra. You mustn't be a dog in the manger."
I said I shouldn't mind if it was someone good enough for him. She stared at me curiously.
"Doesn't he attract you at all?" "At your age, I couldn't have resisted him for a minute. Not looks like that."
"And it's more than looks, of course."
"Oh, I know he has a splendid character," I said. "That wasn't what I meant," said Topaz, laughing. "But I promised your father not to put ideas into your head about Stephen. So let's leave it at that." I knew perfectly well what she had meant. But if Stephen is physically attractive, why don't I get attracted? Really attracted? Or do I?
After breakfast, I went to church. The vicar spotted me from the pulpit and looked most astonished. He came to talk to me afterwards when I was waking Heloise from her nap on one of the oldest tombstones.
"Does this delightful surprise mean you have any particular axe to grind with God?" he inquired.
It didn't, of course, though I had taken the opportunity to pray for Rose.
I don't believe that church prayers are particularly efficacious, but one can't waste all that kneeling on hard hassocks.
"No, I just dropped in," I said lamely. "Well, come and have a glass of sherry," he suggested, "and see how well the collie dog rug looks on my sofa." But I told him I had to talk to Miss Marcy, and hurried after her. Seeing her was my real reason for coming, of course. She obligingly dived straight into the subject to which I had meant to lead up.
"Isn't it splendid about Stephen?" she said, blinking delightedly. "5 guineas for just one day. Nearly 6 if he saves the money that was sent for taxes. So thoughtful. How kind Mrs. Foxcotton must be."
I didn't find out anything interesting. Stephen had come to her for a guide to London. There isn't one in the library, but she had helped him with advice. When I left her, she was still burbling about the wonderful chance for him and Mrs. Foxcotton's kindness. Miss Marcy isn't the woman of the world Topaz and I are. Stephen didn't come home until late in the evening.
"Well, how did you get on?" asked Topaz, much to my relief because I had made up my mind not to question him. He said he had taken the right bus and only been lost for a few minutes while he was looking for the house. Mrs. Foxcotton had driven him back to the station and taken him round London on the way. "She was nice," he added. "She looked quite different, very businesslike in trousers, like a man. You never saw such a huge great camera as she has."
Topaz asked what he had worn for the photographs.
"A shirt and some corduroy trousers that were there.
but she said they all look too new. I'm to wear them for work, and then they'll be all right for next time.
So you're going again?
I tried to make it sound very casual. He said yes, she was going to send for him the next time she had a free Sunday, probably in about a month. Then he told us about the broken bits of statues he had been photographed with, and what ages the lighting had taken, and how he had lunch with Mr. and Mrs. Fox Cotton.
The studio's at the back of their house, he explained. You wouldn't believe that house. The carpets feel like moss, and the hall has a black marble floor. Mr. Fox Cotton asked to be remembered to you, Mrs. Mortmain, ma'am.
He went to wash while Topaz got him some supper.
It's all right, she said. I misjudged the woman.
I talked to him when he came back, and everything seemed natural and easy again. He told me he had wanted to buy me a present, but all the shops were closed, of course. All I could get was some chocolate from the slot machine on the station platform, and I don't suppose it's special London chocolate.
He was too tired to eat much. After he had gone to bed, I thought of him falling asleep in that dank little room, with pictures of the studio and the Fox Cotton's rich house dancing in front of his eyes. It was odd to think he had been seeing things I had never seen. It made him seem very separate somehow, and much more grown up. Next morning, I had something else to think about. Two parcels arrived for me. Nobody has sent me a parcel since we quarrelled with Aunt Millicent. The last one she sent had bed socks in it, most hideous but not to be sneezed at on winter nights. They are finishing their lives as window wedges. I could hardly believe it when I saw my name on labels from two Bond Street shops, and the things inside were much more unbelievable. First, I unpacked an enormous round box of chocolates, and then a manuscript book bound in pale blue leather, tooled in gold. The pages, 200 of them, I counted, have dazzling gilt edges, and there are blue and gold stars on the end papers. Topaz said it must have cost at least 2 guineas. There was no card in either of the parcels, but of course I remembered Simon had promised me a box of candy if I let him look at my journal. And he had sent me a new journal, too. There was nothing for Rose.
He can send me presents because he thinks of me as a child, I pointed out. He's probably afraid you wouldn't accept them.
Then he's a pessimist, she said, grinning.
Well, eat all you can anyway, I told her. You can pay me back when you're engaged. You'll get dozens of boxes then. She took one, but I could see that it was the idea of owning them that mattered to her, not the chocolates themselves. She didn't eat half as many as Topaz and I did. Rose never was greedy about food. We had scarcely recovered from the excitement of the parcels when the Scotney car arrived. Only the chauffeur was in it. He brought a box of hothouse flowers and a note from Simon asking us all to lunch the next day, even Thomas and Stephen. The flowers weren't addressed to anyone, and the note was for Topaz. She said Simon was being very correct, which was a good sign. She gave the chauffeur a note accepting for all of us but Thomas and Stephen, and saying she was uncertain about them. She didn't like to refuse for them without knowing how they felt, which was just as well because Thomas insisted on cutting school and coming. Stephen said he would sooner die. I ought to have recorded that second visit to Scotney immediately after it happened, but describing May Day had rather exhausted my lust for writing. Now, when I look back, I mostly see the green of the gardens where we spent the afternoon. We stayed on for tea. It was a peaceful, relaxed sort of party. I never felt one bit nervous, as I did when we went to dinner. But the dinner party was more thrilling. It glows in my memory like a dark picture with a luminous centre, candlelight and shining floors and the night pressing against the black windows. Mrs. Cotton was still away, and Simon was very much the host, rather serious and just a bit stately, talking mainly to Father and Topaz. Even with Rose he was surprisingly formal, but he was jolly with me. Neil took a lot of trouble with Thomas, encouraging him to eat a great deal and playing tennis with him. Neil asked Rose and me to play too, but she didn't want to as she hadn't had any practice since she left school. So she and I wandered around on our own and drifted into the biggest greenhouse. It was lovely moving through the hot, moist, heavily scented air, and it felt particularly private. almost as if he were in a separate world from the others. Rose suddenly said,
"Oh, Cassandra, is it going to happen, is it?"
She looked as she used to on Christmas Eve, when we were hanging up our stockings.
"Are you really sure you want it to?" I asked,
and then decided it was a wasted question when she was so obviously determined.
To my surprise, she considered it a long time, staring out across the lawn to where Simon was talking to Father and Topaz.
A pink camellia fell with a little dead thud.
"Yes, quite sure," she said at last, with an edge on her voice. "Up to now it's been like a tale I've been telling myself. Now it's real, and it's got to happen. It's got to."
"Well, I feel as if it will," I told her. And I really did. But greenhouses always give me a waiting, expectant sort of feeling.
Neil pressed another ham on Thomas and 6 pots of jam. Father raised a protest, but it was very mild. He was in a wonderfully good temper. He borrowed a lot of books from Simon and retired to the gatehouse with them as soon as we got home. The next exciting day was when we went for the picnic. They called for us unexpectedly. Father had gone to London again, without any explanation, and Topaz made an excuse not to come, so only Rose and I went. We drove to the sea. It wasn't like an ordinary English picnic because Neil cooked steak over the fire. This is called a barbecue. I have been wondering what that was ever since I read about Br'er Rabbit. The steak was burnt outside and raw inside, but wonderfully romantic. Simon was at his youngest and most American that day. He and Neil kept remembering a picnic they had been on together when they were very little boys, before their parents separated. I suppose they are only gradually getting to know each other again. But I feel sure Neil is already fond of Simon. With Simon, one can't tell. He is so much more reserved. They are both equally kind, but Neil's nature is much warmer, more open. He was nice even to Rose that day. Well, most of the time. Not that I see how anyone could have helped being, because she was at her very best. Perhaps the sea and the fun of cooking the steak did it. Something changed her into a gloriously real person again. She laughed and romped and even slid down sandhills on her stomach. We didn't bathe because none of us had brought suits. A good job, too, as the sea was icy. Simon seemed more fascinated than ever by Rose. Late in the afternoon, when she had just been particularly tomboyish, he said to Neil, "Did you ever see such a change in a girl?"
"No, it's quite an improvement," said Neil. He grinned at Rose, and she pulled a little face at him.
Just for that minute, I felt they were really friendly to each other.
"Do you think it's an improvement?" she asked Simon.
"I'm wondering.
Shall we say it's perfect for the sea and the sunlight, and the other rose is perfect for candlelight? And perhaps what's most perfect of all is to find there are several roses." He was looking straight at her as he said it, and I saw her return the look. But it wasn't like that time at the Scotney dinner table. Her eyes weren't flirtatious. Just for an instant they were wide and defenseless, almost appealing. Then she smiled very sweetly and said, "Thank you, Simon."
"Time to pack up," said Neil. It flashed through my mind that he had felt it was an important moment, just as I had, and didn't want to prolong it. After that, he was as offhand to Rose as ever, and she just ignored him. It was sad, when they had been so friendly all day. Neil had driven coming out, so Simon drove going home, with Rose at the front beside him. I didn't hear them talking much. Simon is a very careful driver, and the winding lanes worry him. It was fun at the back with Neil. He told me lots of interesting things about life in America. They do seem to have a good time there, especially the girls. "Do Rose and I seem very formal and conventional compared with American girls?" I asked.
"Well, hardly conventional," he said, laughing.
"Even Madam with her airs isn't that." He jerked his head towards Rose.
"No, I'd never call any of your family conventional. But, oh, I guess there's formality in the air here. Even the villages are formal. Even you are, in spite of being so cute."
I asked him just what he meant by formality. He found difficulty in putting it into words, but I gather it includes reserve and a sort of tightness. Not that it matters, of course, he added hastily. English people are swell. That was so like Neil. He will joke about England, but he is always most anxious not really to hurt English feelings. After that, we talked about America again, and he told me of a 3,000-mile car drive he made from California to New York. He described how he would arrive in some little town at sunset, coming in through residential quarters, where there were big trees and green lawns with no fences round them, and people sitting on their porches with lighted windows behind them. And then drive through the main street with the shops lit up and the neon signs brilliant against the deep blue sky. I must say, I never thought of neon lighting as romantic before, but he made it sound so. The hotels must be wonderful. Even in quite small towns there is generally one where most of the bedrooms have a private bath. And you get splendid food in places called coffee shops. Then he told me about the scenery in the different states he passed through. The orange groves in California. The cactus in the desert. The hugeness of Texas. The old towns in the south where queer grey moss hangs from the trees. I particularly liked the sound of that. He drove from summer weather to winter, from orange blossom in California to a blizzard in New York. He said a trip like that gives you the whole feel of America marvellously. And even to hear him describe it made America more real for me than anything I have read about it or seen on the pictures. It was still so vivid for him that though each time we drove through a beautiful village he would say, "Yes, very pretty," I could tell he was still seeing America. I told him I was trying to see it too. If one can sometimes get flashes of other people's thoughts by telepathy, one ought to be able to see what their mind's eyes are seeing. "Let's concentrate on it," he said, and took my hand under the rug. We shut our eyes and concentrated hard. I think the pictures I saw were just my imaginings of what he had described, but I did get the strangest feeling of space and freedom. So that when I opened my eyes, the fields and hedges and even the sky seemed so close that they were almost pressing on me. Neil looked quite startled when I told him. He said that was how he felt most of the time in England. Even when we stopped concentrating, he went on holding my hand, but I don't think it meant anything. I rather fancy it as an American habit. On the whole, it felt just friendly and comfortable, though it did occasionally give me an odd flutter round the shoulders. It was dark when we got to the castle. We asked them in, but they were expecting Mrs. Cotton to arrive that evening and had to get back. Father came home while I was describing our day to Topaz. Not one word did he say about what he had been doing in London. He had travelled on the same train as Mrs. Cotton and asked her to dinner on the next Saturday. With Simon and Neil, of course. For once, Topaz really got angry. "Mortmain, how could you?" she simply shouted at him. "What are we to give them? And what on? You know we haven't a stick of dining room furniture." "Oh, give them ham and eggs in the kitchen," said Father. "They won't mind. And they've certainly provided enough ham." We stared at him in utter despair. It was a good thing Rose wasn't there because I really think she might have struck him. He looked so maddeningly arrogant. Suddenly he deflated. "I just felt I had to." All the bravado had gone out of his voice. "She invited us to dine at Scotney again next week, and my God, I think my brain's going. I actually forgot about the dining room furniture. Can't you rig something up?" He looked pleadingly at Topaz. "I can't stand it when he goes humble. It is like seeing a lion sitting up begging. Not that I ever did see one." Topaz rose to the occasion magnificently. "Don't worry. We'll manage. It's fun, in a way. A sort of challenge." She tried to use her most soothing contralto. But it broke a bit. I felt like hugging her. "Let's just look at the dining room," she whispered to me while Father was eating his supper. So we took candles and went along. I can't think what she hoped for, but anyhow, we didn't find it. We didn't find anything but space. Even the carpet was sold with the furniture. We went into the drawing room.
The top of the grand piano would be original, said Topaz.
With Father carving on the keys?
Could we sit on the floor, on cushions? We certainly haven't enough chairs.
We haven't enough cushions either. All we really have enough of is floor.
We laughed until the candle wax ran down onto our hands. After that, we felt better.
In the end, Topaz got Stephen to take the henhouse door off its hinges and make some rough trestles to put it on, and we pushed it close to the window seat, which saved us three chairs. We used the grey brocade curtains from the hall as a tablecloth. They looked magnificent, though the join showed a bit, and they got in the way of our feet. All our silver and good china and glass went long ago, but the vicar lent us his, including his silver candelabra. Of course, we asked him to dinner too, and he came early and sat in the kitchen giving his possessions a final polish while we got dressed. Rose wore Topaz's black dress. We had found it didn't look a bit conventional on Rose. It suited her wonderfully. Our dinner menu was clear soup, made from half the second ham bone, boiled chicken and ham, peaches and cream, the cotton sent the peaches just in time, savoury, deviled ham mousse. Topaz cooked it all, and Ivy Stebbins brought it in. Stephen and Thomas helped her in the kitchen. Nothing unfortunate happened except that Ivy kept staring at Simon's beard. She told me afterwards that it gave her the creeps. Mrs. Cotton was as talkative as ever, but very nice, so easy. I think it was really she who made us feel the dinner was a success. Americans are wonderfully adaptable. Neil and Simon helped with the washing up. They call it doing the dishes. I rather wish they hadn't insisted, because the kitchen looked so very un-American. It was wildly untidy, and Thomas had put all the plates on the floor for Heloise and Abelard to lick. Very wrong indeed, because chicken bones are dangerous to animals. Ivy washed, and we all dried. Then Stephen took Ivy home. She is the same age as I am, but very big and handsome. She obviously has her eye on Stephen. I hadn't realised that before. I suppose it would be an excellent thing for him if he married her, because she is the Stebbins' only child and will inherit the farm. I wondered if he would kiss her on the way home. I wondered if he had ever kissed any girl. Part of my mind went with him through the dark fields, but most of it stayed with the Cottons in the kitchen. Neil was sitting on the table stroking Ab into a coma of bliss. Simon was wandering round examining things. Suddenly the memory of that first time they came here flashed back to me. I hoped Rose had forgotten Simon's shadow looking like the devil. I had almost forgotten it myself. There surely never was a more undevilish man. Soon after that, we were into the exciting part of the evening. It began when Simon asked if they might see over the castle. I had guessed he would and made sure that the bedrooms were tidy. "Light the lantern, Thomas, then we can go up on the walls," I said. I felt the more romantic I could make it, the better for Rose. "We'll start from the hall." We went through the drawing room where the others were talking, that is, Father and Mrs. Cotton were. Topaz was just listening, and the vicar opened his eyes so wide when we went in that I suspected he had been dozing. He looked as if he rather fancied joining us, but I was careful to give him no encouragement. I was hoping to thin our party out, not thicken it up. "The gatehouse first," said Rose, when we got to the hall, and swept through the front door so fast that I saw she meant to skip the dining room. Personally, I thought pure emptiness would have been more distinguished than our bedroom furniture. Little did I know how grateful Rose was to be to the humblest piece of it. As we walked through the courtyard garden, Simon looked up at the mound. "How tall and black Belmont Tower is against the starry sky," he said. I could see he was working himself into a splendidly romantic mood. It was a lovely night with a warm, gentle little breeze. Oh, a most excellently helpful sort of night. I never mount to the top of the gatehouse tower without recalling that first climb, the day we discovered the castle, when Rose kept butting into me from behind. Remembering that
Remembering us as children made me feel extra fond of her and extra determined to do my best for her. All the time we were following the lantern and Simon was marvelling that the heavy stone steps could curve so gracefully, I was willing him to be attracted by her. "This is amazing," he said, as he stepped out at the top. I had never before been up there at night, and it really was rather exciting. Not that we could see anything except the stars and a few lights twinkling at Godsend and over at Four Stones Farm. It was the feel that was exciting, as if the night had drawn closer to us. Thomas set the lantern high on the battlements so that it shone on Rose's hair and face. The rest of her merged into the darkness because of the black dress. The soft wind blew her little chiffon shoulder cape across Simon's face. "That felt like the wings of night," he said, laughing. It was fascinating watching his head next to hers in the lantern light, his so dark and hers so glowing. I tried and tried to think of some way of leaving them by themselves up there, but there are limits to human invention. After a few minutes, we went down far enough to get out on the top of the walls. It took quite a while to walk along them because Neil wanted to know all about defending castles. He was particularly taken with the idea of a trebuchet slinging a dead horse over the walls. Rose tripped over her dress almost the first minute, and after that Simon kept tight hold of her arm, so the time wasn't wasted. He didn't let go until we stepped into the bathroom tower. We left Thomas to show the bathroom. I heard Neil roaring with laughter at Windsor Castle. Rose and I ran on to the bedroom and lit the candles.
"Isn't there some way you can leave us alone together?" she whispered.
I told her I had been hoping to ever since dinner, but it's very difficult. Can't you just lag somewhere? She said she had lagged on the top of the gatehouse tower, but Simon hadn't lagged too. He just said, "Wait a minute with that lantern, Thomas, or Rose won't be able to see," and down I had to go.
"Don't worry. I swear I'll manage something," I told her.
We heard them crossing the landing.
"Who sleeps in the four-poster?" asked Simon as they came in.
"Rose," I said quickly. It happened to be my week for it, but I felt it was more romantic than the iron bedstead for him to picture her in. Then he opened the door to our tower and was very tickled to see Rose's pink evening dress hanging in it. She keeps it there because the frills would get crushed in the wardrobe. "Fancy hanging one's clothes in a 600-year-old tower," he said. Neil put his arm around Miss Blossom and said she was just his type of girl, then knelt on the window seat to look down at the moat. Inspiration came to me. "How'd you like to bathe?" I asked him.
"Love it," he said instantly.
"What? Bathe tonight?"
Thomas simply goggled at me.
"Yes, it'll be fun."
Thank goodness he caught the ghost of a wink I flickered at him and stopped goggling.
"Lend Neil your bathing shorts. I'm afraid there's only one pair, Simon, but you could have them afterwards."
"Rose mustn't bathe because she gets chilled so easily. Heaven forgive me, Rose is as strong as a horse. I am the one who gets chills."
"We'll watch from the window," said Simon.
I unearthed my bathing suit, then ran after Thomas, who was yelling from his room that he couldn't find the shorts. For an awful moment I feared he had left them at school.
"What's the game?" he whispered. "Don't you know the water'll be icy?"
I did, indeed. We never bathe in the moat until July or August, and even then we usually regret it.
"I'll explain later," I told him. "Don't you dare put Neil off."
I found the shorts at last. They were helping to stop up Thomas's draughty chimney. Luckily they're black.
"You'd better change in the bathroom," I called to Neil, "and go down the tower steps. You show him Thomas, and then stay and light us with your lantern. I'll meet you at the moat, Neil."
I gave him the shorts, then went to change in Buffer. Simon called,
"Have a good bathe,"
as I ran through the bedroom, then turned back to Rose. They were sitting on the window seat looking splendidly settled. It was only while I was changing that I fully realized what I had let myself in for. I, who hate cold water so much that even putting on a bathing suit makes me shiver. I went down the kitchen stairs feeling like an Eskimo going to his frozen hell. I had no intention of showing myself in the drawing room, I had outgrown my suit so much that the school motto was stretched right across my chest. So I went to the moat via the ruins beyond the kitchen. Near there, a plank bridge runs across to the wheat field. I sat on it, carefully keeping my feet well above the water. Neil wasn't down. I could see the full length of the moat because the moon was rising. It was casting the most unearthly light across the green wheat, so beautiful that I nearly forgot the horror of having to bathe. How moons do vary. Some are white, some are gold. This was like a dazzling circle of tin. I never saw a moon look so hard before. The water of the moat was black and silver and gold. Silver where the moonlight shimmered on it, gold under the candlelit windows. And while I watched, a gold pool spread around the corner tower as Thomas came out and set the lantern in the doorway. Then Neil came down looking very tall in the black bathing shorts and stepped from lantern light to moonlight.
"Where are you, Cassandra?" he called.
I called back that I was coming, then put one toe in the water to know the worst. It was a far worse worst than I anticipated, and a brave idea I'd had of getting my going-in agonies over by myself and swimming towards him vanished instantly. I felt that a respite of even a few moments was well worth having. So I walked slowly along the edge of the field, with the wheat tickling my legs coldly as I brushed past, sat down on the bank opposite him, and began a bright conversation. Apart from putting off the horror of plunging in, I felt dawdling was advisable in order to give Rose more time, because I was pretty sure that once we did get into the moat, we should very soon get out again. I talked about the beauty of the night. I told him the winning anecdote of how I tried to cross the moat in a clothes basket after I had first heard about coracles. Then I started in on the good long subject of America, but he interrupted me and said, "I believe you're stalling about the swim. I'm going in anyway. Is it deep enough for me to dive?" I said yes, if he was careful.
"Look out for the mud at the bottom," Thomas warned him.
He did a cautious dive and came up looking a very surprised man.
"Gosh, that was cold," he shouted. "And after all the sunshine we've been having."
As if our moat took any notice of sunshine. It is fed by a stream that apparently comes straight from Greenland. I said, "I wonder if I ought to bathe, really, after such a heavy dinner."
"You don't get away with that," said Neil. "It was you who suggested it. Come on, or I'll pull you in. It's really quite bearable."
I said to God, "Please, I'm doing this for my sister. Warm it up a bit." But of course I knew he wouldn't. My last thought before I jumped was that I'd almost sooner die. It was agony, like being skinned with icy knives. I swam madly, telling myself it would be better in a minute and feeling quite sure it wouldn't. Neil swam beside me. I must have looked very grim because he suddenly said, "Say, are you all right?"
"Just," I gasped, pulling myself up onto the plank bridge. "You come right back and keep on swimming," he said. "Or else you must go in and dry yourself. Oh, come on. You'll get used to it."
I slipped into the water again, and it didn't feel quite so bad. By the time we had swum back as far as the drawing room, I was beginning to enjoy it. Topaz and the vicar, framed in the yellow square of the window, were looking down on us. There was no sign of Rose and Simon at the window high above. I hoped they were too engrossed to look out. We swam through a patch of moonlight. It was fun making silver ripples just in front of my eyes, and then to the steps of the corner tower. Thomas had disappeared. I hoped to heaven he hadn't gone back to Rose and Simon. After we turned the corner to the front of the castle, there was no more golden light from the windows or the lantern, nothing but moonlight. We swam on our backs, looking up at the sheer, unbroken walls. Never had they seemed to me so high. The water made slapping, chuckling noises against them, and they gave out a mysterious smell, as when thunder rain starts on a hot day, but dank and weedy, and very much of a nighttime smell too. I asked Neil how he would describe it, but he only said, "Oh, I guess it's just wet stone." I found what he really wanted to think about was boiling oil being poured down on us from the battlements. Everything to do with castle warfare fascinated him, When we reached the gatehouse, he asked how drawbridges worked and was disappointed to find that our present bridge isn't one. We only call it the drawbridge to distinguish it from the Belmont Bridge.